If you want to write stories your readers will love, there are three things you need to do. Understand storytelling principles, see how other writers have applied those principles, and then use them in your own work. Here on the Story Nerd Podcast, our goal is to demystify story theory. We'll help you with the first two steps so that you can get started with the third. My name is Valerie Francis. I am a writer and a literary editor, and I teach women who are writing in all genres how stories work so they can finish their books faster and without frustration.
And I'm Melanie Hill, writer, editor, and poet, and I help writers find solutions to their story problems so that they can finish their novels.
For today's What Went Right episode, Melanie chose The Outrun. This 2024 film was directed by Nora Fingscheid. I hope I'm saying that right. And she wrote the screenplay as well with Amy Liptrot. Of course, there will be spoilers because we can't talk about the movie without talking about the movie. And as always, we would love it if you could help other writers find our show by leaving a rating and review. Apple Podcast listeners, you can do that right from your phone. Scroll to the show's landing page, go to the bottom, click the 5 stars. It is that simple. Okay, Melanie, The Outrun. You know this was a What Went Right episode.
Yes, I did.
Okay, just checking.
Well, I've taken the what went right as a question as more than a statement.
Okay, fair enough. Carry on.
And I was sick because I was watching this and I was going, this is my choice. So all week I was going, why did Valerie choose this movie? And then I realized that it was my choice. So I thought, what was I thinking? And I can't remember. But then I did go and have a look. And this actually gets about 80% on the tomato meter in Rotten Tomatoes. So I picked it, I think, because of that alone. And I thought, well, you know, we watched Saoirse Ronan in that terrible
in the chicken movie.
In that particular movie that we won't mention the name of. And I thought, well, you know, this may be a redeeming thing. And I think it is. I think her performance is really brilliant in this. But yes, I did struggle to remember why I chose the movie. And maybe I was also thinking that it was more of an artistic style of movie, whereas a lot that we have been looking at, particularly for our What Went Wrong and What Went Right episodes, have been more action-based, whereas this is a very internal story. And so I think I was trying to just flip it around a little bit and do something a little bit different. But I did question myself this week, and I have come up with some things too that I think the movie actually does really well. So I think that this movie uses myths and fairy tales to help make the internal story external, and it also gives an explanation perhaps and some insight into what Rona is thinking and how she's feeling at the different points of the movie. And even though the movie itself is non-linear in terms of its timeline, the actual folk tales, fairy tales and myths it uses are very linear. So it, I think, gives a bit of a structure in a movie that doesn't have an enormous amount of linear timeline structure. The other thing that's really interesting and why I think the myths and fairy tales make a lot of sense is because this is a memoir, really. If we were writing this, and it is based on a book as well, if we were writing this, it would be considered memoir more so, I think, than if it was something like a mini plot kind of story, which it is, but I think I would classify this more as memoir, which makes more sense then in terms of the non-linear timeline as well. And the other thing that I found really interesting as I was contemplating this movie this week is because it's memoir, it doesn't need to be factual in the way that a biography needs to be factual. Memoirs can focus on the author's emotional experience based on their memories, And memoirs are also organized around a theme. And so the theme is really about Rona's alcoholism and how she battles against the addiction and the illness that she has. And so I think the fairy tales fit into that sort of style of storytelling quite well, which is probably a more academic approach to this movie than I would maybe normally take. But at the same time, I do think it does this really well. And so Rona's internal journey to sobriety is represented by the Orkney stories. And like I mentioned before, I think this is one way to make the internal external, particularly in memoir, and especially in a visual format as opposed to a written format. Now, I'm going to focus on the use of imagery and the myths and the fairy tales to represent Rona's state of mind, because they are important and they help us make sense of her story. And just as an aside, so I really love fairy tales, and in previous intros into our episodes, I have said that I write fairy tales, and I do. And I believe that fairy tales are very important. And from the Australian Fairy Tale Society's website, because I was looking about, well, how can I explain how important I think fairy tales are? And what fairy tales do is they are put the focus on an individual who is following the life of a character archetype that can represent aspects of humanity. And they work as a psychological code telling external truths about human nature in dreamlike imagery. And their focus is on being truthful rather than being realistic. And hence, that's why I think it's a really nice way to tell Rona's story. Now, for Rona, the truths, the fairy tales, and the myths signal are about being stranded in a life that's not hers. They talk about the need to disappear and then also the enduring continual struggle with malevolent forces. So these stories are important to Rona because, as G.K. Chesterton said, fairy tales do not give the child their first idea of bogey. What fairy tales give the child is their first clear idea of the possibility of defeating the bogey. And that is why they are important. And I think they are important in this movie. So fairy tales represent universal truths and are coded into most of us from a very young age. They give us ways to defeat the obstacles that we face. And that is another slight variation on Lisa Cron's book, which Valerie and I have talked about through many seasons, that stories give us a way of seeing and dealing with the world. So this is just a more, even more traditional and enduring way of dealing with that and using stories to help us cope with solving problems. So when Rona tells us the story of the Selkies right at the start, what she is telling us is that alcohol is her Selkie skin. Without it, she feels stranded and can't return to a state that she believes that she belongs in. And at one point in the movie, she tells her friend in rehab that she can't be happy sober. So the longing of the Selkies and alcoholics are very similar in this. So it's a metaphor. So the Selkie story is a metaphor. Selkies stranded on land often abandon their families if they recover their skins. So the desire to be in the sea is that strong. Now, being in seal form then is their return to their true nature. And at this point of the story, this is true to Rona. Her need to drink destroys her relationship with Danan. She is abusive and ultimately ends up being beaten by a stranger. So she has given away all of these good things just to go and feel happy by having a drink. And so, I see these parallels with the Selkie story and Rona's story at that point in her life. Now, telling the Selkie story first is important. Each alcoholic Rona encounters all tell her the same thing then throughout the story, that being a recovering alcoholic never gets easier it just gets less hard because they too are Selkies stranded, but they have outrun their longing for a drink. Now, the Selkie story also establishes the powerful connection between Rona and water. There is a very clear image system in this movie, and water is the central part of that image system. In fairy tale traditions, there are strong motifs that represent darkness and light. So both are omnipresent in this movie. Water is destructive as it smashes against the cliffs and the island, but it is also healing. So the ocean grows the seaweed that Rona becomes focused on, and swimming is cleansing and it strengthens her resolve. So the swimming is also symbolic of her returning to herself, just like the Selkies do when they finish dancing. The water surrounds the island and provides Rona with the isolation that she needs also to help her come to terms with her illness. And then we have a look at the next fairy tale that's mentioned, or actually it's actually a myth if we're really honest, and that's about Assipattle and the Storeworm. Now, this story is the key to Rona helping herself. Assipattle is a creation myth. It has a cosmic origin around it. And so Rona needs, just like Assipattle, to travel inside the belly of the beast to set fire to it to create a new world for herself. So she has to face the monster inside of herself and not run from it. And even if she does conquer it, some of the monster will burn away forever. So the monster won't die, but it can be tamed. And we hear that in the tale of Assipattle as well, that the liver keeps burning and is still burning throughout time. And if you go back and actually read the full story, the liver burning is Iceland. So this talks about, this is a creation story for the Shetlands, Orkney, and also a lot of those Nordic countries. So that's really interesting as well. I'd never heard of this myth, so I was quite fascinated to go and do a bit of research. All right, and then, of course, then there's the lovely little story about the underground corn crakes. And right after Rona tells the story about the corn crakes and that they were thought to go underground in winter or transform into other species or ride on other birds back to migrate, and then notes that now they know that these corn crakes fly from Orkney down to Africa, but it's quite a hazardous trip and only 30% make it. And that is a really interesting part of the story, because right after Rona tells that story, there's a flashback in time to the day that she finds Danan gone from their home. And then it moves into the present day and she discovers her father in a depressive episode and she drinks his wine. So this is at the midpoint of the story. The corncrake's impossible journey and any attempts to save them can appear hopeless. So the corncrake's migration is like Rona's journey to sobriety. Most won't make it. And the counsellor, when she goes into rehab, actually says the same thing to the group when they start. And I think she even says that about 30% of them will actually only make it through the rehab journey. So there's a really nice parallel there as well. And then we have the story of Heather Blether, which is told when Rona goes to Papi. Now, Papi is the island, and it appears for Rona while she's on the flight going in the fog, and it's the fog of her relapse. And then she will leave it only when the fog is lifted or clear. So the story that Rona tells, though, in the movie is different from other ones that are told about Heather Blether on Orkney. So there is another version where a young woman meets a mysterious man who she trusts immediately, and he asks her to return to his home on the island. And when she meets his family, she feels a sense of belonging that is overwhelming for her, and she stays with him. And then her father, who has been spending years looking for her, one day stumbles across the island as it appears out of the mist. And they meet and they hug, and he is reassured that she is safe. And then she gives him a knife, which will help him with his fishing because her father's a fisherman, and it will also help him find her. However, he loses the knife and never returns, so he never sees his daughter again. Now, I think I like this version a lot better because I think in relation to Rona, it represents the choices that she makes to go to Pappy instead of being kidnapped, right? So if there is an agency about this second story that I like for her, and I think that's what she's doing. She's choosing to go there as opposed to being kidnapped and used, forced against her will to go into isolation. But I also like the second story better because it references, I think, Rona's love for her father, but also recognises that he loses his ability to return to her because of his bipolar disease. Now, finally, there's the fierce battle of the Sea Mither and Terran, which is evident in this story, although it's not directly referred to. So this is one of the oldest Orkney fairy tales, and this story symbolises the continual fight between the calm and the chaos of the weather in Orkney, and it plays out in the gales and the fierceness of the seas in winter and the calmness and the warmth in summer. So the Sea Mither is a friendly spirit that lives in the sea, and the spirit would keep turbulent waters calm and warm in the summer months. And her presence is felt through the gentle breezes over the calm waters on the islands of Orkney. Terran, however, is the winter spirit, and he is the nemesis of the Sea Mither. And Terran is responsible for the heavy storms during winter and the harsh and rough conditions of the seas. So the Sea Mither and Terran go to battle with each other around the spring equinox. And this fierce battle goes on for weeks and is known as the spring struggle. The battle explains the gales, the strong winds that pummel the lands and the sea around this time as well. And this story always ends the same way, with the Sea Mither banishing Terran to the depths of the water and restoring calm and serenity to the sea over the summer months. And then around autumn, Terran breaks free again, and the cycle of the battle repeats itself. And there's another version of this story that includes the Nukalavi, which is a monster that lives in the ocean that resembles water horses and kelpies, but is actually much worse and far more frightening in its physical description. It's quite grotesque. Anyway, the Sea Mither's fight to contain Terran and subdue the Nukalavi are metaphors, I think, for Rona's struggle with alcoholism. And the ending montage of Rona conducting the waterways, the dances, and finally the ocean in Orkney and on Pappy are symbolic of her taming her illness for the time being. And I think that there's a lovely poetic resonance between the story of the Sea Mither and Rona. And I do think it's there behind the story, even if it's not referenced directly. Now, the recurring imagery of water is important to Rona and also in Orkney fairy tales. Water is a force that breaks and drowns, but it is also a force for cleansing. And water gives life to sea creatures and generates 60% of the Earth's oxygen. So it also delivers Rona a new future. The kelp she finds on the shores in Pappy is symbolic of the life-changing potential of her new focus, and it's delivered to her by the sea. There are also other mythic symbols in this movie, such as the Ringer's Brogda, which is a stone circle. And although the Ring of Brogda isn't related to any time-travelling stories, Rona is transported back to a night in her memory when Danann and her were together, when she touches the actual one of the stones in the ring. And there's a whole big myth around like stone rings, right, for anyone who's interested in Outlander, you know, these are the kind of things that really resonate and spark a lot of mystery, and especially around time travel and parallel timelines. But just to finish up, I actually really loved Rona's poem at the end as she's reciting that as she's getting ready to leave Papi. The imagery of her body as an island surrounded by the sea shows that she has found her place again and that she is anchored and at home in her body. So they are the things that I think that this movie got really right. And it took a lot more hard work for me to find that this week. And once I found them, I actually found myself enjoying the movie. And when I watched it the second time with that understanding, it spoke to me a lot more, even though there were parts of it that I still found a little bit confusing. All right, Valerie, what did you make of it?
I agree with everything you said. And I really like your comment there right at the end, because this is a film that you've got to be prepared to work for.
Mm.
It's not, well, when I first sat down to watch it, I was really tired and I just watched a couple of minutes, went, nope, can't do this one right now. Because you need to work.
Mm.
You need to work at it. You cannot just sit back and be entertained by it, or you will get lost. It will just be really confusing and you'll probably just think, yeah, I don't get it. Okay. So the second time I sat down to watch it, I was much more rested. Even then, by 23 minutes in, I'd already stopped it twice. There's not a lot happening. I feel like I need to preface everything I'm about to say. I don't want to sound like I'm cranky or negative because there's a lot of really great stuff happening. In terms of the fairy tales and everything that Melanie just said, it is based on a memoir. Again, as Melanie said, Saoirse Ronan is fantastic. I just love her. And this is, there's a lot of women working on this movie. So there's a lot of reasons to support the movie. It is the kind of film that I can appreciate for its artistic merit. I found the first half of it very difficult to get through. If you're not prepared to sit down and work at it, you're going to not make it to the second half. The second half of the movie I found much more interesting. There's a lot more story happening in the second half of it. And the movie is more coherent. And of course, I'm a story nerd. I'm all about the story of it. I run out of patience very quickly when a body of work is too reliant on a metaphor, or when I have to have a pen and paper to follow it, or if I have to watch it 5 and 6 times to really understand it. To me, I think that's a problem, because there's very few people who are going to do that. So if your goal is to make a film or write a book that is actually going to make money, and you want to quit your day job, or you want to get it published by a traditional publisher, you've got to think about the economics of it. I'll say more about that in a minute. All right. So The Outrun is a mini plot story. Okay. We've talked about that before here on the show. Mini plot stories are much less popular in today's society, especially in film. And mini plot stories are a lot harder to pull off. The degree of writing difficulty is way higher in a mini plot story. It's hard for a novel, right? But it's even harder in film, because with a movie, this is a visual medium. And in a mini plot story, the conflict is primarily internal to the protagonist. So that's very difficult to show a picture of. So it's not a form of story that pairs easily with movies, although it can be done. It certainly can be done. Now, if you need a refresher, go back and listen to season 5 of the podcast, because that's where I really get into a discussion of the shapes of stories. And if you've listened to that and you want even more information, go check out our Story Trinity course, because I go into it in even more detail there. If you are writing a story where the primary conflict is internal to the character. You're probably going to need the Story Trinity course to really help you get through it. Now, the arc plot or classic story form is by far the most popular story form in our culture today. When we think of a story, we are thinking of this classic story form. But that doesn't mean it's the only shape. It's not. It's one of four. There's the classic or arc plot story form. There's mini plot, there's multi plot, and there's anti plot. That's the last one. Now, in a novel, a writer has access to the character's internal world, right? That's sort of, we shine in that area because as the author, our narrators can go right into the head of the characters. Can't do that in film. That's why in films you get things like voiceovers because they're trying to bridge that gap somehow. And there's voiceover in The Outrun. So in a novel, in prose, it's relatively or comparatively easier to write a mini plot story than it is for a filmmaker to create a film out of it. Great. Now, I'll just add this very quickly because Melanie, I think you've done a lot of this heavy lifting already, and I don't want to repeat everything that you've just said. The fairy tales and myths are doing a lot of the heavy lifting, right, with showing Rona's internal turmoil. But holy cow, you can't miss nature. Like you cannot miss all the waves crashing and the wind blowing. The wind blows right into their home and the storm's raging. This is the inner storm within Rona raging. And if you think back to the Bourne identity, which could not be more different from The Outrun if it tried, but they also use water and the storms raging as a way of conveying the internal turmoil in Jason Bourne, right? So this is the kind of thing that you don't have to be creating an art film or writing high literature to tap into this kind of stuff. So that's kind of fun. I can really appreciate that level of artistry. With the caveat that it should not and cannot eclipse the storytelling. That kind of stuff it enhances the storytelling. It doesn't replace it. So never forget that what you're doing is writing a story. Because that's why anyone buys a book, right? You buy a book because you want a story. You go into the cabin for the weekend and you want a book to read. You have you have to take a train or a subway to your commute in the morning. The book passes the time for you, or you just want to escape from, frankly, the world, which is wackadoodle right now. You want to just go into a fictional world for a half an hour and unwind. We are looking for a story. So that's job number one. So with the classic story form, that's a story. With mini plot stories, just like the classic stories, the four story questions have got to be clear. If they're not, you're going to lose your audience. You just will. And if you need a refresher on the four story questions, go back to season 13 because I talked about them there. And again, if you want a deeper dive into them, I cover them more in the Trinity course, the Story Trinity course. So very quickly, the four story questions are, who is the protagonist? What do they want? What or who's standing in the way of them getting it? And what happens if they don't get it? So what do they want? That's the object of desire. The standing in the way of them getting it, that's the forces of antagonism. And what happens if she doesn't get it? That's the stakes for the story. All right, so Rona's our main character. That's the answer to question one. Question two, what does she want? Already it's getting murky because I caught myself imposing my attitudes and my beliefs and my suppositions. And I shouldn't do that. I should be able to clearly state what this character wants. It's not what I want. It's not what I would want in that situation. Because what I would want if I was like that, to me, that it's logical to think, well, what she wants is to get sober. Ah, but is that clear from Rona's perspective? It is not. And I refer you back to everything Melanie just said about the Selkies and where they naturally live, right? Their natural skin. Melanie, I'm so glad you articulated it much better than me this week. So we could say, if she's an alcoholic, of course she wants to get sober. No, because the other thing I pulled out is exactly the same thing you pulled out, Melanie, which is she explicitly says to the other person who's in rehab with her, she can't be happy sober. So what is it that she wants? We should know it. Even if this is a mini plot, that should be really clear. Because it gives us, it's like an anchor point in a story. Without it, there's just this narrative unfolding and we don't, it's almost like an odyssey. We don't know where it's going. There's no rhyme nor reason. Stuff is happening, but it doesn't make any sense because it's directionless action. Okay, so question three is all about the forces of antagonism. Now, in a mini-plot story, the main antagonist is the main character. She is her own worst enemy because the main source of conflict is within herself, okay? I mean, that's what makes a mini-plot stories that where they tend to be internal genre stories. Okay, fine. Now we're coming to the stakes. What is at stake for Rona if she doesn't get what she wants? Because her object of desire is not clear, the stakes are unclear. This is a really big problem. Please, 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 I'm begging you to have clear stakes for your reader. Make it clear. Don't get clever with this. This is not the place to be artistic and clever. These are the types of things you've got to really nail for your reader. Okay. If Rona doesn't care about something, if Rona doesn't feel those stakes, we don't feel those stakes, which means we don't feel tension, which means there's no reason for us to keep turning the page because we're not wondering what's going to happen next. And a huge mistake I see with writers is that because they're so focused on the internal quest of the character, they don't think that these kinds of storytelling principles applies to what they're writing. Nothing could be further from the truth. These are foundational principles of storytelling. Any form of story, this is the kind of stuff. Now, again, we can extrapolate stakes. If we're going to extrapolate the object of desire, we can extrapolate stakes. For instance, well, if her object of desire is to get sober, what happens if she doesn't get sober? Does that mean she'll be doomed to live a lonely and tortured life like her father? Okay, that's a reading of it. The question then becomes, well, how does Rona feel about that? Is that so bad in her mind? If that means she can keep drinking alcohol and alcohol is where she feels happy, is being lonely necessarily a bad thing? Because remember, we're looking at it from the character's point of view, not from our point of view. We're not judging her in one direction or the other. We just need to understand where her head is on it. Because again, if she doesn't care about something, we don't care about it either. Is she accepting who she is? If her father is sick like that, maybe she just says, oh, genetically, that's just who I am. Like, these are all questions. I have no idea what the answer is to any of these types of things. Because there's not enough concrete anything in the film for me to know the answers to these. Okay. You know, this is a movie that is inviting us to interpret what's happening. And yes, there is artistic merit in that. Absolutely. I'm not going to argue with that. But what I will say is that this is where you, as an artist, have got to start to get really honest with yourself. And I do mean brutally honest. ask yourself this question. Why are you writing your book? Whatever story it is you're working on, why have you chosen to devote many years of your life to telling that particular story? Now, there's no wrong answer here, but there is your answer and you need to know what it is. If you are writing a book because you want to get published, especially if you want to be published traditionally, if you're doing this because you want people to read your book and you want to see your book on the shelf of your local bookstore or maybe even on a bestseller list, then your reader has to know with 100% certainty what is at stake for your character. I know, okay, what I'm about to say right now, I'm expecting to get some letters on because this kind of stuff, this foundational stuff I'm talking about, is even more important than the line writing of your book, okay? Now, I'm saying that again with a little caveat. Readers assume that your line writing is fine, right? When they go into a bookstore, they're assuming that all the books in that bookstore are written by people who have a really solid understanding of grammar and can string some sentences together in a pleasing way. That's just the price of admission to this business. I mean, it really is. But even that, it's secondary to the storytelling. This is a truth that took me a very long time to accept. So if you're having trouble believing me, I get it. I totally get it. What I invite you to do is look at the books on your bookshelf. Look at the books in the bookstore with a critical eye. Look at the bestseller list with a critical eye and ask yourself, what is it about these books, the books that tend to stand the test of time and are around for a while? What's capturing people's imagination? And it's the story. There's a lot of A-list writers whose prose, I mean, it's fine, it's adequate, but I mean, it's not poetry, it's not anything, it's not Shakespeare, it's not special. It does the job. A reader will forgive sort of bland-ish prose if the story is really compelling. And I just want to give you one example that I am experiencing right now. I am reading a book called Chasing Evil. Now, it's nonfiction, and it is written by a retired FBI agent named Bob Hilland and John Edward. Yep, the psychic. I'm not kidding. Now, it's 90% Hilland, and it's just John Edward every once in a while pops in. So this is, John clearly has penned this thing. The line writing is quite poor, not going to lie. But the man is a career FBI agent. He's an excellent FBI agent, and I will take that any day because we need those. He doesn't admit to being a writer. He admits to being a damn good FBI agent, right? But the story that he is telling is so compelling. I cannot put this book down. I was reading it all the way up to the time we got here to record, and as soon as we finish recording, I'm going right back to it again. I cannot put this thing down, and I am not a true crime junkie at all. In fact, I tend to stay away from the true crime stuff because it gives me nightmares usually. But the stakes in this book are so high, I'm completely addicted. And it's not just life and death stakes in the outside world because he's going after a serial killer. I mean, that's pretty compelling because people's lives are at stake. But it's also personal stakes for Hilland, his marriage, which falls apart because of the demands of his job, his relationship with his children, which falls apart because of the demands of his job. The stakes are really high. He personally stands to lose everything. You cannot help but empathize with this guy as a protagonist because his colleagues keep telling him, drop this case because you're going to lose your marriage. And he's like, you seriously want me to leave a serial killer out there and he kills his wives and we know he just got married again? You seriously want me to walk away? How? These are just best bad choices all over the place. He is constantly making choices on that level. It's amazing. It's amazing. And of course, because it's got John Edward, the psychic, in it, I mean, it's got just enough woo-woo in it, just enough of the supernatural. It's just like dangling the bait in front of me. I love it. I love it. Oh my God. It's Chasing Evil by Robert Hilland and John Edward. I'm telling you, you got to check it out. Now, The Outrun is totally different than Chasing Evil. Okay. I mean, you know, granted, these are not similar stories at all. But my point is that no matter what kind of story that we're writing, our audiences have got to feel tension. And that tension is created by stakes. What happens if the main character doesn't get what she wants? What is it that she wants? Is it clear to your audience? That has to be there no matter what kind of story that you're writing. Now, we're way over time, but I'm still going to mention one other thing quickly, Melanie, and that's the timeline. It's nonlinear, but it's really nonlinear. Like, by nonlinear, I mean there's flashbacks and flash forwards, but this one really jumps around a lot. And it's very difficult, especially in the first half of the story, to figure out when things are happening. They give us some visual cues, like the color of Rona's hair. We can sort of link together. But again, unless you're going to sit down and watch it a couple of times with a pen and paper, and really, it's too hard to remember. Oh yeah, what else happened when she was blonde with blue tips in her hair? I can't remember. And then when her hair was all blue, I can't remember what other scenes happened when her hair was all blue. It's hard to follow from that point of view. So if you are going to use a nonlinear timeline, that is, if you are using flashbacks and flash forwards, make it really clear to your reader where in time they are, where and when in time they are, so that they don't get confused. Because any amount of confusion, they're going to put your book down and walk away. I mean, it's just that simple. All right, I'm going to stop there. And it's high time for me to stop. Okay, Melanie, what is the bottom line as far as you're concerned when it comes to The Outrun?
Well, I think it's interesting to watch from a memoir perspective. So my bottom line is that if you are writing memoir, the thing to remember is that you don't have to be literal or factual. Memoir is centered around a theme, and using myths and fairy tales, which are deeply encoded into our storytelling DNA, is one way to help readers make sense of the author's experience. And we actually cover off memoir a little bit more and go into greater detail about what it is and how it works in our Trinity Story course, which is now available. So, and Valerie mentioned it just before, but it is a really fascinating, different way of storytelling, and it doesn't have to be biography. So that's sort of what I think is the bottom line from this story. What about you?
Here's what I want people to remember. The bottom line here, make sure that every decision that you are making about your story is a strategic one. If you choose a form that is not a classic story form, have a really good reason for that. Because you're making your life a lot more difficult. and I do mean a lot more difficult. It, you know, it's not like a little bit harder. It's, you know, 10 times harder. It's exponentially harder to write a mini plot story than it is to write a classic story form. So just make sure you're aware of that, and that every decision you make in your story is strategic. All right, Melanie. That wraps it up for this week. Woohoo! At last, we have come to the end. Now, we would love to know what everyone thinks of this What Went Right episode. So feel free to reach out to us on socials and let us know. And if there is a film that you would like us to take a look at, you can let us know that as well. Next week, we are starting season 16. We're going to start off, we're going to kick it off. Episode one will be the, I think it's 1991 film by Ron Howard, Backdraft. To support the show, please leave us a rating and review and tell your writer friends about us. For more information on our online training courses, visit storynerd.ca/courses. To join my inner circle, go to valeriefrancis.ca/innercircle. And for tips about books to help you read like a writer, go to Melanie's website, melaniehill.au. And remember, story theory doesn't have to be difficult. It's a tool to help you write more, not less. So take it one step at a time and have fun.